Hi, I'm Brandi Olson, and you're listening to the Afro Uprising Podcast.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. I am your host today, Andy Cleff, and I'm really pleased to be joined by Brandi Olson, who's a speaker, an author, a teacher, an Agile strategist, an organizational designer, and above all, a human-centered everything. Brandi, what is something, anything, a secret power that you'd like to share with our listeners? Something maybe not in your LinkedIn profile.
Yes. Good morning. Something not in my LinkedIn profile is that I used to lead backpacking trips out in the upper peninsula of Michigan. And so if ever you break your femur and need to be evacuated out of the woods, I'm your person and I can help you do that.
You can do a field splint?
I can do a field splint. I can build a kit to carry you out of the woods. But most of my training, my medical training in outdoor education, was really about being able to distinguish, do you need a Band-Aid or do you need to be evacuated?
Sweet. So how long were these trips? What duration? How much stuff? More importantly, how much baggage did everybody have to carry for you?
Not a lot of baggage was allowed. These were long trips. So a short trip would have been a week. A long trip would have been 2 or 3 weeks. And we took high school students and college students out into the woods to learn about themselves and survival and teams.
Were these a supported trip where you had a van carrying all the marshmallows in the water?
No, these were pack everything on your back and go. And if you need something, you have to hike out and find someone to give you a ride somewhere and help you find a cell phone. So they were pretty remote, pretty wild. And I'm surprised all the time how much I use those skills. Not so much the femur setting. I haven't gotten to set a femur in a very long time. Actually, I've never set a femur. But I'm surprised at how much of those backpacking skills I use now in my work. It's one of the best jobs I've ever had.
You know, and I think that's a good segue into the topic of this podcast. Bring what you need. Leave the rest mm-hmm. behind. So we crossed paths not too long ago, Agile 2019 in DC. You gave a talk. It was wonderful. The real cost of organizational multitasking. And I think the subtitle was Start Less, Finish More. Mm-hmm. And if we tie it into backpacking, it's like pack less and use what you bring, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. It's about simplify, bring only what you need, and then use the people around you and the space that you're at to figure out the rest.
Interesting. So let's start with my favorite approach, definition, multitasking, and then we can dive into some of the research. So when you talk about the real cost of multitasking, is it different at an organizational level? Is it different from an individual level?
Yeah, great question.
What do you mean by multitasking?
So multitasking at the individual level is the word we use to describe what's happening when we're switching between topics or tasks or conversations. It's a misnomer though, because our brains don't actually do two things at the same time, but it's what we refer to when we're doing more than one thing at the same time or trying to do more than one thing at the same time. And there's a lot of research and science out there about how our brains operate in that context. But what I get a lot more interested in is what happens when you have groups of people multitasking all day long or trying to accomplish or do multiple things at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that's what I call organizational multitasking, which is really anytime you have a group of people pursuing so many things simultaneously that quality starts to suffer, or there starts to be an impact from that pursuit of doing multiple things at the same time.
I've had so many discussions with so many people, and it started, I have two wonderful daughters that are now adults, and they came of age differently than I think you and I did, where screens were constantly present in their lives, and they were doing their homework and texting their friends. And I see the same thing in the workplace. And if I ask anybody on a team, you know, show of hands, who's really good at multitasking? You'll see all the hands go up, right? People think mm-hmm. they have big brains and everybody is above average on this. And in the workplace where there is so much to do and you're in a team. So what is the cost of this? I mean, everybody's got a big brain, right? I can start one thing and park it and do another thing and park it.
Yep.
Is that multitasking, or, you know, I'm doing a code review and I'm also watching a YouTube video?
Yeah, all of those are multitasking according to that definition, right? When you're trying to perform two tasks at the same time. The reality, though, is a lot of us get pretty good at that. We can perform well, even though we are switching back and forth. It doesn't mean, though, that we're not paying a cost for it, that switching from doing that code review to following that YouTube video doesn't mean that we might be able to do that, but we still pay a cost for the switch in terms of our mental capacity and what our brain's trying to do to manage that. But those costs are pretty minimal. So the conversation about organizational multitasking isn't so much about how me as an individual gets my work done in a day. It's much more, there is a cost to that. We could have a conversation about that. But the cost of multitasking, the loss of brain energy and just exhaustion and time, is heavier the more complex the task gets. So I can send emails and I can listen to a podcast at the same time and probably not have my quality suffer too much. But if I'm sending emails and listening to a podcast and also simultaneously trying to go back to that big strategic design document that I've been working on and prep for facilitation session that I'm doing, I might find that it takes me all day to get that document done. When if in reality I just spent an hour focusing on it, I could have gotten it done a lot sooner. So there's always a cost to pay in terms of time and efficiency when we're switching between tasks, and that cost goes up the more complex the work is, or we start to see quality suffer the more complex the work is.
So let me play devil's advocate for a bit. You have a team of people. Why not split it up? You know, why not take that strategic report and have three different people work on it and get it done in a third of the time? Is that still considered organizational multitasking?
Actually, that's a really good example of the opposite of organizational multitasking. So how about a story? A
sure.
Story can be really helpful when we're trying to break this down. If you think about, so there's the individual, and we could talk about how our brains work and why multitasking becomes so costly. And I think that might be an interesting segue after my story. But you've got a team of people and they're doing that multitasking. Organizational multitasking happens when, say, you have a team and they have a list of priorities, they have a backlog they're working on. Mm-hmm. Organizational multitasking would be what happens if somebody tells that team, you have to get all 10 of these things done this week at the same time, and I want you to start them all, and I want to see the progress that you're making every single day on all 10 of these items. That would, we'd call that organizational multitasking, especially if the team gets spread so thin trying to work on all of those different projects that they become inefficient in their time, or their quality suffers, or they just get tired and exhausted and kind of burnt out because they wind up working really long hours. To the opposite of that, organizational focus would be when we often do this with teams. We say, work on this thing first and get it done, and then work on the next thing. And teams a lot of times can do that pretty well. However, when you get outside of that team and you have teams of teams working on something, and you look over across an organization and say, how many things are we trying to pursue at the same time? How many projects do we have in progress? How many initiatives do we have that we're trying to make progress on all at the same time? You start to see organizations don't do very well managing their multitasking.
So you suggested that we talk about how a brain works. Mm-hmm. Is the function of an individual's brain, you know, how my brain works as a unit, do we also need to look through the lens of how does a collective brain of a team work as a set? Are they the mm-hmm. same? Are they different?
Well, they all start with the person at the center of it. And so it starts with understanding that we're each individuals and we each get one body, one brain. And so the reality is the way our brains are wired to work and the way they've evolved over millions of years is that our brains can do one task at a time. And so in our brain, the part of our brain that's responsible for things like planning, problem solving, analysis, also the part of our brain that's responsible for context switching. So going from I'm doing this to I'm doing that, context switching or multitasking. It's called the executive functioning capacity of our brain. And what's really happening in our brain when we're multitasking or context switching is that our brain's doing two things. It's paying attention to goal shifting. So I was writing this email and now I'm in a conversation with you. The goal of each of those tasks is different. And so my brain is rapidly switching between identifying what the purpose of the email was and why I'm in a conversation with you and what we're trying to talk about. So that's an executive functioning task. So it's goal shifting. The other thing my brain is doing is rule activation. So all day long, every time we're engaged in conversations with people or we're engaged in tasks, there's rules that apply about how we interact or what's appropriate, what the social and emotional guidelines are for the interaction, and our brain is constantly evaluating that. So there are rules that apply to how I write an email to a client versus how I might write an email to my mom. And there's rules that apply to what's appropriate in our interaction here on this podcast versus the interactions that I might have when I'm leading a portfolio planning session with a large organization. And so my brain is constantly evaluating the situation I'm in and figuring out what rules to apply. So when we're context switching, we're asking our brain to go back and forth between the different goals that we're trying to get done and then the rules that apply to that. And that's an executive functioning task. And our brain can only do one executive functioning task at the same time. So that means if I am asking my brain to goal shift and figure out what's the goal over here when I'm leading this workshop or preparing for a workshop versus having a podcast conversation, my brain is not engaged in problem solving or communication management. My brain's not engaged in planning. I'm only doing that goal shifting. Now, my brain can switch back and forth between all of those executive functioning tasks very quickly, but it's still a switch, and I'm still asking my brain then to do more of that goal switching or more of that rule activation every time I switch what I'm trying to accomplish.
So it's a little easier if we finish what we're doing, pause, and then move on to the next thing. Let's scale it up, right? Mm-hmm. So you got a bunch of smart people. They're on teams and they're required to use this high order thinking skill, these executive skill sets, right? Are there ways to measure or help people visualize? Because honestly, I don't know any organization that doesn't take these groups of people and put them in this scaled problem of we've got to get all of this done, which forces us into just the edge or slightly over the edge of multitasking, right? So what do we see and how do we visualize this to know or show the doubting folks that, yeah, this is a problem?
Yeah, so there's some really interesting research about what happens when we're engaged in context switching or multitasking. And I go back to, it's the individual level, but then we will scale it in a second. But what happens in that scaled environment is we buy into all of these illusions about how to be more productive and how to be more effective. And one of those illusions is that getting started on everything mm-hmm. is the way to get it done. And if everything's important, then we have to do it all at the same time. And so we get stuck in that illusion as organizations and as leaders that, well, it's all important, so we have to do it. Where that breaks down is because of the reality of how our brains work, right? We talked about the executive functioning tasks. There's some pretty compelling research that's been demonstrated over and over again in the scientific literature that shows that if I'm engaged in one task or one project or one initiative, I get to spend 100% of my brain capacity doing that one thing, whatever it is. If I try to engage in two projects, say in the course of a day, and I'm switching back and forth between those two projects, I spend 40% of my brain capacity and my energy in context switching activities like goal shifting and rule activation. 40% of my brain capacity goes to those context switching activities, which means that I'm losing time throughout the day. And that 40% of waste, I would call that waste.
Yeah, there's no value production.
No value production, right? It's lost in moments and seconds. It's very slippery. So we don't notice it because it's just, it kind of slips away. Because our brains actually, we can go back and forth between and do that goal switching a lot. So that's if you're trying to get two things done simultaneously. If I try to get three things done, say I have three projects that I'm trying to work on, I'll spend up to 60% wow. of my energy context switching on goal shifting and rule activation. And that leaves me 40% of all of my other brain capacity and energy to actually solve the problems that I'm trying to solve. And so the waste that comes from that becomes very significant, and it's slippery. We don't see it. We don't see that time disappear. We don't see that energy disappear. We just feel it at the end of the day. If you've had a day where you've been going from meeting to meeting to meeting, and every meeting's about a different topic and with a different group of people, you get to the end of the day and you just feel exhausted. And yet you look at your day and you're like, what did I get done today? And yet I'm so tired. That feeling, that's the cost of context switching. And that's the reality of spending 40, 60% of your time and your brain capacity just switching back and forth. And that's just with three projects. I have this conversation a lot with leaders that I work with, all sorts of different companies. And we get to this conversation about what happens if you're splitting your time between three efforts and how you're wasting about 60% of your energy.
Yeah.
And then I always ask leaders to say, how many of you feel like three would just be a dream? Only do three things and only have three things on your plate at any given time. And everybody raises their hand and everybody laughs, because we know that most of us have not just three things. We've got 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 or more things that we're trying to manage, especially if you're a leader who's got people reporting to you and multiple teams that you support and multiple initiatives that you're trying to drive forward.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Is what comes to mind, right? So I can imagine in this scenario, at the end of the day, people feel burnt. And I wonder what impact that has on quality, right? Mm-hmm. And problem solving. And then it just begins to amplify the problem. When you're burnt out, you solve the easiest thing next, which isn't necessarily the most important one, which then leads to, well, further pressure the next day for the higher priority thing that didn't get done.
Or one of the even bigger costs or risks in that scenario is that you're not even solving the right problem. One of the costs of having entire teams of people who are running around at 40% brain capacity because they're trying to accomplish so many things. And then you maybe say teams of teams. You have an entire organization of people who are operating on a multitasking brain, means that they're less likely to be able to identify the root causes, the real problems. And there's so much pressure to keep moving forward that it feels like one of the other illusions it plays, it feels like, well, we can't even slow down to figure this out. And I think, how many times have we found ourselves in a meeting where you hear everything that's going on and the group is so invested in moving towards a solution, and somebody's thinking, you know, in the back of their head, gosh, I don't even think we're solving the right problem, but we've invested so much time already and we're so far along on the solution that we can't go back. We don't have time to do that because we're spending all of our time on goal shifting and rule activation.
That we aren't really getting anything done. And then it's the good old sunk cost fallacy. So when we look at this problem at organizational scale, where should people start looking for solutions? Is it at the individual level where someone learns to say no or yes, not now? Is it something that starts at a leadership layer? Where do you focus? What would you recommend, Brandy?
So a lot of times we think about it as an individual problem, but the way to solve the problem is that we all need to be more efficient in the way that we work. The reality, though, is it's not something that we can solve individually. And it's a problem that really sits with our leaders. The challenge is we don't often connect the reality of organizational multitasking with the real cost at play. So if you think about a group of people or an entire organization that's constantly engaged in multitasking, some of the costs that start to emerge from that are that we're not solving the right problems. Mm-hmm. We have lower quality. We also see that we have higher employee turnover. There's lack of equity or diversity in the workspace, and people get burnt out. And when we look at how those kinds of problems typically get addressed in the workplace, they typically get addressed by solving the symptoms. So if we know we have an employee turnover problem where people are getting burnt out, we emphasize the individual response of finding more balance. And if you're burnt out, you need to find better work-life balance. Or as a company, maybe we offer more frozen yogurt in the lobby or have yoga rooms to deal with the symptoms of that. But the underlying cause of that is organizations that put people in the position of trying to pursue too many things at the same time. And that's the root issue, but it seems almost impossible to solve at an individual level. And it seems really challenging to solve at an organizational level if a leader is looking at that.
What are some of the approaches that you have found to be useful at an organizational level to help the organization see or separate the symptom from the root cause?
Well, so I think that it helps when we start to make the reality visible and when we start to see and make visible the costs of that. So Kronos, they're a large time management human resources company that works across the world, big software company. They did a research study in 2017 and they surveyed over 600 companies and their human resource leaders about some of the biggest threats to their workforce, human resource workforce. And the leaders, over 80% of the leaders said that employee turnover was one of the biggest threats to their workforce. Kronos then went and surveyed the employees at those 600 companies. And employees overwhelmingly named two of the top three reasons that they were leaving companies as having too much work to do and unrealistic overtime. So too much overtime and unrealistic work expectations. So the employees were saying, the reason we're leaving is because there's unrealistic expectations about how much we can get done in a day and how much overtime we have to work. They were getting burnt out because of multitasking. But you go back to those same HR leaders, and over a fifth of those HR leaders said that even though employee turnover was a threat to their workforce, a fifth of them said they wouldn't be doing anything about it in the next year because of too many competing priorities.
How ironic.
What was really interesting, though, was the conclusion of the entire study was that employee turnover is a significant threat to many companies, and yet there's no obvious solution on the horizon.
We're too busy to address it. In fact, we have a little too much work in progress to do with the work in progress issue. The irony just makes me giggle a little bit.
Right? Yeah, that there's nothing we can do about it. And I think that's the overwhelming illusion that many leaders and many organizations buy into, that there's, it's a problem, but there's too much important work to do. We have too many problems to solve, too many opportunities to pursue. And we have this illusion, again, going back to how we work as individuals, we have this illusion that we can capacity plan by cutting everybody's time up. So if we have five projects and I need you to do work on those, well, I can allocate 20% of your time to those five projects and you can get all that work done. That's the illusion, that as an individual, you can break up your time between those projects and it'll all add back up to 100% of your time.
Yeah.
The reality is, because we pay such a high cost for that multitasking and there's so much waste, dividing your time into increments of 20% over five projects doesn't add up to 100. You're paying a huge cost for working on each of those projects throughout your day or your week.
So steps four don't sound easy. Can we at least make them simple?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, solving it at the systemic or organizational level, where to start? I mean, obviously people see it. You know, I'm curious, the industries that the Kronos study, and maybe we can get a copy if you have it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
In the notes. So I'm assuming it's creative knowledge work, not, you know, assembly line stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of our listeners can identify with that. And I'm just trying to think of, what are the places for people to start at an organizational level, right? How do we help leaders and the teams and the groups figure out how to start less, finish more, and what they work on is small enough that it can be finished. Mm-hmm. And what they work on is the right thing to work on next.
Yeah. So at the team level, we have a lot of great practices that Scrum gives us, that the Agile values and principles give us to teach us about how to manage this at the team level. Baked into a typical agile team is a backlog. That's a linked list of work to do, and teams pay attention to getting started, getting finished, and how much work they have in progress. But because once you get outside of that team, the pressure of most organizations is so strong to solve problems, to get more done with less, to be higher performing, some of those basic principles of agility get lost, and we don't apply them at the system level or the portfolio level, but the same principles and the patterns apply. So I think one of the most powerful ways to start is to just make the reality visible of how many different efforts are in progress across an organization. And I think this works at the team level, but it works at a portfolio or a team of teams level. And it also works at an entire enterprise level. But when you start to pay attention to that, insights start to emerge. So I was working with a company a couple of years ago, and it was a smallish company. I was working with the CEO and the CTO and their team of like 10 direct reports. And so I had them do this exercise, get sticky notes out and just put up on the wall all of the efforts and initiatives and projects they were working on. And then also the things that were taking their time on a regular basis, their like day-to-day job responsibilities. And so this was a company that had 12 agile scrum teams and they 10 leaders. They put everything on the board and they had over 100 projects in progress and that their teams were working on. And that means that each of those teams was in progress trying to make progress on 2, 3, 4, 5 initiatives at the same time.
At the same time. Yep.
And there were only 10 leaders. So that means those 10 leaders as well, each had, you know, 8 to 12 different big initiatives that they were trying to drive forward. And the reality of that, when we put it all up on the wall and started looking at that, there was this collective sigh of validation on the part of all of those leaders, of validating that no wonder I feel exhausted all the time. And no wonder it's so hard to wrap my arms around all of this. And it's not because I'm not a high performer. I think we buy into this illusion that high performance means doing everything at the same time, and that that's the way to get more accomplished or deliver more value, when really it has such a huge cost. And so it just started with those leaders putting that up on the wall. I've done that same exercise with big global companies that work with hundreds of scrum teams and agile teams.
I love that approach. It's taking the internal world of all these leaders. I'm overwhelmed. I don't know why I'm exhausted. I don't know why I'm working 80 hours a week, and making that reality visible in the easiest way we know, right?
Yep.
Big
put it on a wall,
post-it notes, and it leads to the realization of, holy crap, no wonder I'm exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do next?
Yeah. So that's where it starts. And then what you do next is the same thing that we teach teams to do, scrum teams. You start to pay attention to what's the natural amount of work that your group can handle at any given time. You pay attention to your work in progress and you start to look at what's the amount of work that we can handle in progress without paying costs, without having our quality suffer, without burning out, without losing creativity and innovation. And that's going to be different for every group. But you start paying attention to that. And so I encourage portfolio leaders, I encourage company leaders, I encourage teams. If your team is dealing with this, it starts here, is to try to put a limit in place, right? Lean practices give us this idea of WIP limits and limiting your work in progress. It's really about creating a boundary and saying, I realize that my group can usually handle about 3 different initiatives at any given time and do that pretty well. And so maybe our limit's 3. Let's try that. Or maybe you've got a group and there's 50 teams involved and you look at it and you say, we can handle about 15 big initiatives, right? Or maybe it's every team can handle 1 and the WIP limit for each team is 1, which sets an overall portfolio limit. But if you have no boundary around what you get, how much you have in progress. So if you have no boundary, that causes 2 problems. The problem first is that it doesn't dive with reality. Our brains have boundaries.
Yeah.
So if you don't proactively put a boundary in place, boundaries will come find you in devastating ways. They will come find you through employee turnover. And so you just have less people who can do work. They will come find you when you get sick at the most inopportune times. Boundaries always find us. So if we can proactively put boundaries in place, then we have a reason to talk about priorities. If you have no limit in what you can start, there's very little need to talk about prioritization. If you put a boundary in place, then you naturally start to have a conversation of, well, what's the next most important thing that we should be pursuing? And that's a much more helpful and much more interesting conversation to be having at a leadership level.
Yeah, I like that. And also the other end of the line is, how do we know when we're done? Mm-hmm. Right. And so if we're in this great pull system of, we have capacity, we are ready to take the next piece, how do we know when we're done?
Mm-hmm. And we know how powerful that conversation is at the team level, or the, you know, level of really small chunks of work. We know that that conversation around, how do we know we're done? How do we know when we're ready to do something else? That's a really important conversation to have. And sometimes it's surprising how rarely that conversation happens at a portfolio level.
Interesting. You know, we're looking at these team practices and saying, if we move them fractally to the next level, they will work. And we keep moving them to the organizational level, they work. I wonder why that's not propagating. What pressures in this system are keeping the push pressure on?
The cognitive illusions are so powerful. And I think it's because it's hard to see the cost of multitasking. And it's hard to see the cost of all that context switching because it's so slippery. And because we have a culture in our American Western culture, we have a culture that rewards productivity. And somewhere along the way, we let it get ingrained into our collective culture that productivity means doing as many things as possible at the same time.
Busyness,
right?
Outputs, not outcomes.
Reward those outputs, exactly. And yet we know that that's not what we want to be accountable for, even for a leader who knows that and believes that very deeply, that they want to be rewarding outcomes. They want to be delivering on things that add meaningful value. They don't want to just be rewarding busyness, even for that leader. The pressure and the illusions are so powerful that make it feel so scary to say, we're going to do one thing at a time or 10 things at a time instead of 100 things at a time. They're so powerful. And so we have to engage in the conversations in some different ways, I think, because if all we needed was the research to tell us that it doesn't work like that, most of us would be existing in very different kinds of companies. But the research alone isn't enough to compel us to really change our behaviors and the ways that we make decisions.
Yeah, some of those protective barriers that you talked about that are part of the Scrum and Kanban frameworks, just what's bouncing around in my head is how we scale that to the highest levels of the organization to make that thinking ever present. Mm-hmm. And one thing that bubbles up is outcome. You know, what is the outcome you want here? Mm-hmm. And how many of those can we support at any given time? And what's the smallest piece we can deliver? Mm-hmm. Going back to backpacking, right? You know, how much can you realistically carry to the next base camp?
Well, in physical space, it's easier to see, right? So if you're backpacking or you're moving boxes, we can physically feel and see the boundaries and the natural limits to what we can accomplish, right? There's only so much I can carry in my backpack, or if I'm carrying boxes, I can carry two, maybe three big boxes, or maybe just one. Like there's just a real limit that's very visible to what we can do at any given time. When we're doing knowledge work, creative work, all of that's happening inside our brains. And so we don't have that same visible physical limitation. And yet it's still there. It doesn't go away. It's just easier to ignore. Again, I think the pressures that so many of our organizations deal with, they're real. And when we talk about prioritization or setting a WIP limit, I can talk about that as a coach and a consultant. And it sounds really pretty on paper. And it sounds like a really nice idea. And a lot of the resistance I get to that is, yeah, but that doesn't work with my reality, because we have regulators breathing down our necks and we have to meet these regulatory deadlines, or the market is so competitive right now, we can't afford to not do it all at the same time. And they're not wrong. The, you know, those leaders, teams who see those pressures, they're not wrong about everything being important or there being a real need to pursue new opportunities. And that's the leader I like to speak to, because there's other scenarios in which it's obvious. Yeah, you're pursuing things that don't add value. You're doing things that you probably shouldn't be doing. But what about those leaders? What about those organizations who really, everything's important? That's the hardest place to overcome, because it feels really risky to say, we're going to limit our work in progress. And there's a cognitive dissonance. We feel like if we limit our work in progress, we might not get it all done. And I want to acknowledge that that's a really valid concern and a really valid challenge. I was working with a group of leaders. This was probably a year and a half ago. I was facilitating a portfolio design and planning session.
Yeah.
And so I had given them some homework to prioritize. They'd already done the work of, okay, here's everything we've got in progress. And they put it all on the wall. And I gave them the homework to prioritize it. So that's the next step, right? We're going to have a prioritization conversation. And so they came back to our next session and they prioritized everything. And they prioritized things as high critical, high important, high, medium critical, medium important, and essential. Like those were their prioritization categories. And so with a lot of empathy for their situation, I had to break the news, and they felt really proud of it. So I should say this, these are really committed leaders. These are leaders who care about their teams. They care about the work that they're doing, and they're smart people. So this is what they came back with. And so I had to gently break the news to them that they had in fact not prioritized anything, because we still didn't understand what the next most important thing to pursue was. Their pushback was, but it's all important. We prioritize everything based on its importance, right? Which left them with 15 number one priorities.
Yeah.
And so we asked them to rank order those priorities instead. And this is another one of those principles that we get from our team practices, right? Our backlogs always rank ordered. And I asked them to rank order instead. And instead of prioritizing based on importance, we asked them to prioritize based on the outcomes and the value that would be delivered. And again, I can say this out loud and it sounds so simple. We all agree we're going to prioritize based on business value that we deliver. That's what our backlogs are supposed to be. But that difference allowed them to have a different kind of conversation. And they did the work of prioritizing based on the outcome that they thought would be delivered and how soon they needed that outcome. But it wasn't easy for them to do, but they did it. And it freed up their teams in a really significant way. And ultimately, what they found at the end of that year is they'd gotten everything on their list done. And they got it, some of it was done sooner. And then some of it was done in with a level of quality that they didn't expect, that they weren't used to delivering at. But because they prioritized and they agreed to a limit, and a boundary about how much they would pursue at any given time, they were able to get that done. The other thing that they noticed was that they had higher team level satisfaction, right? It's not shocking, but it's powerful when you actually see it in practice. And they didn't think that that was possible.
It's nice when you get some data points to give back. So it's not recency bias or opinion that informs. The last project was great, so this is going well. Or the last quote deadline was missed, so this sucks. So often the organization and the leadership's approach is, I want certainty. And honestly, in the worlds we travel in, there's very little certainty. I think the approach that you're talking about provides a level of comfort in a world that's constantly changing. And as we travel the path back to hiking, you know, we can see where we're going to be tomorrow. And we have some idea that we have that the strength to make it, but we're camping here tonight. We're good. There's that comfort over certainty. And part of it comes from visualizing what's happening, imagining, you know, what's going to go wrong.
Yeah. Seeing it, because that helps us live in reality. And if the work that we're doing and we're pursuing is important, if it matters, we have to do it in reality. And reality is there's constraints and there's boundaries in the ways that we work as individuals and the ways that we work as groups. And I think that there's something deeply comforting and freeing, especially for our leaders, about embracing that reality. Because if we know that we're pursuing a path in which it's impossible, like, you know, you embark on something like there's no way we have enough hours to get all of these things done. Internally, that's really uncomfortable. And it pushes us into a place where we have to put on a facade, right? We think that we can't name that truth of we can't pursue it all at the same time. But in the name of high performance or meeting our goals, we think that that's what we have to do. But to be able to reframe and be able to say, oh, the path to high performance isn't doing everything at the same time. It's focus and prioritization. That actually leads to high performance. That's really freeing because it's actually more possible that we could get there. And so it's not about lowering standards or doing less work even. It's just fundamentally reframing how we get the work done.
And making sure that it's the right work that we are moving towards. Mm-hmm. Wonderful place to end up. We're coming up on the end of that time box here. And I want to give you a chance to share any upcoming events that you've got going on in the next couple of weeks, some shout outs, yeah. And also the best ways for our listeners to get in touch with you, Brandy.
Great. Well, I've got a couple of fun things coming up. In December, I'm speaking at the 3M Innovation Conference. I'll be doing the keynote there on this very topic. And the conversation that we have is about how do we get out of our heads in this space and actually understand these problems in a much more experiential way. So I'm really looking forward to working and speaking at that conference. People can find me on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn a lot. I'm on Twitter occasionally, but LinkedIn's much more my pace of thinking. And you can also find me at my website, helloolson.com. And I have there a really small mini course, I guess is the best way to frame it, that you can sign up for. And it's just a series of 3 or 4 emails that'll come to your inbox with some steps on exactly what we just talked about, how to get started and what to do. And it's really geared towards leaders. And I think it's a great tool to share with somebody. So if you're listening to this and you're feeling like I'm preaching to the choir, which I might be, that's great. But I bet you have some people in your world who are still kind of buying into some of those cognitive illusions and you'd like to help change the conversation. And so that little mini course is really designed to be some tools that you can share and ideas for how to change the conversation and start having a different conversation so that you can embrace reality a little bit more to getting with them.
Thanks again, Brandy, for joining us and to your listening audience for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, give us a review, a rating, leave some comments on the podcasting platform that you use. It really helps others find us. And if this is your first time tuning in, welcome, subscribe, catch the next one. If you'd like to join the discussion and share your stories on how above average you are at multitasking, like doing code reviews, enjoying a craft beer, and listening to a podcast, come on over to coalition.agileuprising.com and share those stories. Finally, support from listeners just like you help us cover our hosting and podcast costs. So to help out, see the show notes and become a patron. $5 a month will send you some good swag. Until next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast, signing out. Be good. Do one thing at a time.